Stay tuned for Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Hey, I was wondering, are you doing anything tonight? Are you free?
No, I'm not doing anything tonight. Why?
You want to go out on a date?
Ooh, a date, huh? I have plans.
Plans with what?
Actually, I have plans with my radio.
Your radio?
Because I'm listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
Oh, well, we could listen to KUCI in Irvine together.
No.
Good morning and welcome to this January 14th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more information on that later in this hour. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. It's my pleasure to welcome novelists Maggie Shipstead and Lily King to the show this morning. Maggie is with me now. Lily will join me for the second half of the show, so you definitely don't want to miss out on that. Maggie Shipstead is the author of two novels, Astonish Me and Seating Arrangements, which won the Dylan Thomas Prize and the LA Times Book Prize for first fiction. She's a graduate of Harvard and the Iowa Writers Workshop and a former Wallace Stegner Fellow at Stanford. Her writing has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the San Francisco Chronicle, on and on, including the Best American Short Stories and Tin House. La Moretta, a story published in VQR, was a National Magazine Award finalist. She lives in L.A., but she's originally right down the road from us in Mission Viejo, and it's my pleasure to welcome her this morning. Maggie, hi.
Hi, Maria. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I didn't realize until yesterday that you grew up right down the street and went to St. Margaret's, and I love that.
Yeah.
Well, welcome.
Yeah, given the subject, especially my first book, nobody expects me to be from SoCal, but I found.
I hope that's not true. I know. I hope that's not true. Okay, so I'm going to give you a chance to introduce Astonish Me, talk a little bit about kind of the scope of the novel for people who haven't picked it up. I want to mention to our listeners that it is just out now in paperback, so you can find it all over the place. So kind of take us into it for people who aren't as familiar with it and sort of the inspiration for the novel.
Sure. Astonish Me started as a short story, actually, that I couldn't quite get to work. And the same was true of my first book. And it was a short story about a woman who'd been a professional ballet dancer in a New York company that sort of goes unnamed. And she's incredibly talented and dedicated, but never sort of rises beyond the entry level here in a company called the Corps de Ballet. And it was about her retiring from dance and moving to Orange County, actually, with her husband and son, and sort of how she copes with life after giving up this discipline that had sort of completely shaped her childhood and her youth and young adulthood. And I went to revise the story, and it just sort of grew and grew and grew and became this novel, which still follows the same character. But it covers about 30 years, and her son becomes a dancer. She has had a really ill-fated love affair with a Soviet defector that the book kind of loops around back to. She's instrumental in helping him defect, and then he kind of drops her. So it has sort of a lot of scope for being a fairly short book, and is about dance, but it's also about, if you're an artist, how do you sort of contend with the boundaries of your talent, and what do you do when you have to make a life sort of outside your art form?
Yeah, I was really interested in that idea of when you can't be great, is it okay to be good enough? And I thought that was kind of a universal question that every artist or creative person tends to struggle with. And I was wondering if through the course of writing this, your mind changed about anything with respect to any of the arts, or is this kind of a unique animal for ballet?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, ballet is so different because, well, it's basically the opposite of being a fiction writer. So it sort of allowed me to address some of my own anxieties, but in a really oblique way because, you know, ballet is so physical. It's so collaborative. Dancers' careers are so short. You know, even if you're a big star and you're lucky and aren't injured, you probably stop in your early 40s, whereas for most writers, that kind of tends to be where people start to peak. So I don't know. I mean, for Joan, Joan's the main character of the book. Her decision to leave dance is sort of precipitated by her getting pregnant, which makes it very simple for her. But she's sort of, her life is driven by this disappointment that she'll never be as good as she wants to be, and she can't force herself to be as good as she wants to be. And that I certainly relate to. I think as a writer, when I read a book that I think is just extraordinary, you know, it's just sort of this feeling of like, how did this person do this? Like, what's their secret? How come the words come together for them in this way? Although, of course, sort of relentless work is a part of all art, I think.
Yeah, it's funny because you've described yourself as a perfectionist, but then also the ability, the need, really, to have to let go of something and get it published. Otherwise, you know, you just get stuck in the mire of everything, you know, jamming up on your computer and never making it out into the world. But
yeah, yeah.
I think that's an interesting line to balance of this perfectionism and the need to let go.
I agree, and I see plenty of writers who just slave over something for what I would argue is too long. I think eventually, there are plenty of counterexamples. Like, I loved Anthony Doerr's book, All the Light We Cannot See, and I think he worked on it for almost a decade, and it seems like that was time well spent, you know, looking at it. But for me, I think after a couple years, my work wouldn't really continue to improve, and it's a better use of my time, I think, to just finally reach that moment where I'm like, well, this is what it's going to be. I tried my best, and then move on to the next thing and try something new, which is something I've always liked about writing short stories, is like sort of a laboratory almost for trying new approaches, and you sort of contend with a beginning, a middle, and an end without having to invest, you know, years of your time.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about that, writing short stories, because I think, did your first novel, Seating Arrangements, come from a short story as well?
Yeah, also a story, but just kind of failed.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think that your novels are popping out of the heads of short stories. I feel like there's a mythological image here that I'm not making a connection to. But
Athena, yeah.
Yeah, Athena, right. But tell me a little bit about that process, because I've always wondered if you're either essentially a novelist or if you're essentially a short story writer. And you've said that you probably tend to underwrite scenes, that you underdescribe scenes. And I was wondering if that's sort of the short story writer in you coming out in the novel. So tell me a little bit about your relationship with short stories versus your relationship with novels and how they feed, how one feeds the other.
Sure. I think I'm primarily a novelist. It's by far my natural inclination. Writing novels is weirdly easier for me than writing stories, although it takes much longer. Stories are such a struggle. But they are sort of how I got into writing fiction. Like most people, I took class, in my case, it was in college, and wrote some stories. And as a senior thesis, I wrote a little collection of stories. And then I went to graduate school, where I had to go to a workshop every week and turn in two pieces a semester. And I kind of knew that I wasn't ready to write a novel. I knew I didn't really know how to go about that. And so I wrote stories through grad school, and then after I finished, I spent 8 months living on Nantucket. I had like a little bit of fellowship money, and I had a little money saved, and I wrote the whole first draft of Seating Arrangements in that time. And I think if I had been somewhere where I had to balance a job and kind of normal life, it would have been much more difficult, but I just sort of doggedly kept going, and kind of had that typical experience with a novel where you sort of realize all the things that are wrong with it right when it's done or when the draft was done. And then after that, I had a fellowship at Stanford where I was also going to workshop once a week. I don't know if you can hear my dog growling. He's growling incessantly for some reason.
I thought it was my stomach. Okay.
No, it's trash day, so he's on high alert. So then I was back sort of in a workshop setting and again wrote stories. And for me, it was really the best way to make use of this time and having feedback from other writers to be able to present them with something finished instead of pieces of a novel, which sort of requires a lot of guesswork to critique. But I think with stories, I feel a little scared to experiment with structure and with different voices. I've never felt very comfortable writing in first person, but I've done it a couple times in the stories now, and so in the novel I'm working on now, I'll use first person, not for the whole thing, but for part of it. So for me, stories are sort of places where I can work on new skills, and not to say that they aren't worthwhile in their own right. I also just admire so deeply really amazing stories. I think they're these perfect little crystallizations, but that's sort of difficult for me. I'm more of a, I can yammer on for hundreds of pages, but I can't really always distill what I want to say into something so brief.
Right, right. Yeah, it's an amazing skill to have, and I keep hearing about, you know, the dismal state of short stories and, you know, how it's hard to get them sold and all of that. So I was wondering what kept drawing you back to them, and that's a great answer. Yeah. It's a good place to experiment.
Yeah, and, I mean, they do good things for you being out in the world. I mean, most of my stories have been published just in relatively small literary magazines, but there's a little bit of street cred that comes with that, and one of my stories was in Best American Short Stories, which at that time I wasn't even working on a novel, and it was helpful as far as kind of being noticed by editors and agents, that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I think within the literary world, people do pay attention. I think more people are writing stories than ever, probably because MFAs are so common now.
Right, right. And I do feel like it's making some sort of comeback. I mean, I certainly see a lot of collections on the shelves. So, you know, and they're winning prizes.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, yeah. It's funny because to draw back to the novel, I'll remind our listeners that you're tuned in to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I am on with Maggie Shipstead. The novel is Astonish Me. And it's new out in paperback, so you can look for it there. It's funny, I was listening to NPR the other day. Alexander Chi had chosen your book as the book that he wanted to introduce people to and tell them about. And as a male reading about kind of this world of ballet dancers, he said, I thought it was very interesting that she explored the dark side of women's friendships, and we always hear how close and cohesive women's friendships are and how cool they are, but we never hear about how dark they are. And I thought, what a funny perspective. I only hear about how dark they are, and I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So it was funny to hear the male point of view on female friendships and what they think female friendships are about versus what they're, you know, oftentimes actually about.
Yeah.
But tell me a little bit about digging into the women in the novel, the female characters, and how you accessed these women and what difficulties they gave you in writing them.
Sure. I would say I have a more difficult time writing women characters than I do writing men, oddly enough. My first book had a male protagonist, a man in his late 50s, and for some reason that just felt completely natural. And then when I write about women in their 30s, it's like, oh, what could they possibly be thinking?
Right.
But so Joan has this friend, Sandy, who lives next door, and Sandy was in the book from the beginning. It's in the short story, actually. And she's a suburban mom. She has this little daughter. She has a marriage that's not particularly happy. She's carrying around a few extra pounds, like most of us. And suddenly this woman moves in next door who's this incredibly slender former ballerina with her son, who seems to be very bright. And Sandy's kind of a good time girl in a way, and her impulse is to make friends with people, but she has a really hard time not resenting Joan for being, for her physicality, for being so little, and also for not being very much fun in Sandy's mind. Like, Joan won't kind of eat and drink with abandon. She's, this discipline of ballet is still sort of clinging to her in a way. But they live next door, so they're sort of locked together for a long time, and their children forge a relationship of their own because they both end up dancing. So, yeah, I mean, I think I'm sort of permanently interested in female friendship, which I do think is complex. That's funny what Alex Chu said about being introduced to the dark side, because I think my most important friendships are with women. But they do tend to sort of evolve and change shape in ways that my friendships with men don't necessarily. And I think women are sort of socially conditioned to expect real intimacy from their female friends, and in a way that men maybe aren't with each other. So maybe that's part of what is surprising, just this assumption on the part of the characters that that there's at least the potential for something really intimate to flourish between them.
Yeah, that's really well observed. Isn't that true, that women the relationships are both slightly competitive and, you know, ribbons of jealousy and ribbons of comparison, and yet this really deep forged intimacy often, and, you know, bearing your soul in a way you can't with men, and, you know, the sexual competition, and it goes on and on. And especially in the world of ballet, where I think women I don't know anything about that world until now, but have to be ultra competitive, and the body image issues and the age issues and all of it. This really seems to be the apex of where you could explore that dynamic of
and there's so little space. You know, I think ballet dancers are always hoping to get promoted within the company, and meanwhile, every year they're taking in new young dancers straight out of, you know, school, and so there's progressively less and less room. And I think that could really stick in your psyche a little bit. And I kind of forgot to say that really the driving force of the short story was the way parents of young children can be very competitive about their children's futures, which don't even exist. It's this sort of hypothetical competition. And so I really wanted to bring that in with Joan and Sandy, too, sort of this idea of, like, well, my child's probably gifted. Well, my child's probably gifted. Nobody really knows for a long
potential
time.
Right. That's great. That's great. Now, I read that you wrote a lot of this novel while you were in Paris, and I was wondering if being in a particular setting colors the novel, if you think it would have been the same novel given the place you were when you wrote it, given the surroundings that you were surrounded by. Do you think that, you know, your environment seeps in somehow into the storyline?
Well, it was really helpful, of course, being there. So I had finished my fellowship at Stanford, and I had a year before Seating Arrangements was published, and I didn't need to get another job, and I didn't really live anywhere, so I spent most of that year traveling. So I had actually been, this is really disgusting, but I had been in Bali for a month, and then I went to Paris for 3 months, and then I was in Edinburgh for a month. And those 5 months were really when I wrote this whole book. And by the time I left Bali, just after that month, I had what was a complete draft, but it was really short. It was less than 100 pages, about 95 pages. So I already had Paris kind of worked into the story. But then when I got to Paris, and I was living in an apartment complex that's just for artists, and Stanford owns an apartment there and generously allowed me to go. It's an amazing location. It's right on the Seine, right in the Marais. Mm. So then, you know, inevitably the Paris section expanded, and it was really incredible to, you know, write a scene set on the Pont des Arts and be able to walk, you know, 3 blocks and go stand on it and make sure I got the view right, you know, write a section set in the opera house, the Palais Garnier, and just go and see a performance and get the details right, which is always really important to me. But I did most of my writing in Paris in Starbucks, which is sort of the most corporate, lame place you could possibly work. So, I don't know.
Did you live with ballet dancers in sort of an intimate way to kind of get into their back lives and talk a little bit about your research experience?
I didn't, and I never danced. My mom's a really serious ballet fan, and she put me in, you know, baby ballet when I was five, and it just was really clear it wasn't going to work out. And so she was like, that's fine. She didn't care if I danced, but she wanted someone who would go to the ballet with her. So since I was in kindergarten, she's had season tickets to the ballet season at Segerstrom Hall.
Oh, yeah.
The Performing Arts Center, yeah. So we would see probably four ballets a year. So for someone who doesn't dance, we've sort of cumulatively seen a lot of ballet, and my mom's really knowledgeable, so we talked a lot about ballet. But then as I was writing the book, especially because I was in these exotic places, I did a lot of research just by reading what I could, and I watched a lot of YouTube, which I probably couldn't have written this book without YouTube. There are just incredible ballet resources out there now. Some companies are really engaged with social media, like the Royal Ballet has an entire company class online, so I could watch an hour and 15-minute long class and really hear how the ballet mistress talks to the dancers, and the rehearsals are online, and interviews with dancers, and little, you know, documentaries. Wow. So I just kind of gathered as much as I could, and then I crossed my fingers at a certain point. And so far, from like one of the first people to review the book was a former dancer at New York City Ballet, and she said it was right on. So that was sort of the biggest relief in the whole process.
That is fantastic. That's great. My guest this morning is Maggie Shipstead. The book is Astonish Me, and you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So I also wanted to chat about the structure of the book, and you've talked about trying to structure it a little bit like a ballet with kind of these frenzied scenes and this, you know, dizzying conclusion and kind of the way ballet, the rhythms of a ballet. But it moves back and forth through time. It's a fairly complicated structure. So talk a little bit about that, keeping the forest straight from the trees, how you set up your home office to kind of keep, well, your home office and Starbucks in Paris, but to try and keep it all straight.
Yeah, I wanted there to be sort of a little bit of breathlessness, like there is in a ballet, and that sort of swelling feeling you get when you're sort of swept away on this kind of melodrama. So it's maybe half a notch away from reality or from strict realism. But I can't even explain how the structure happened because I didn't outline the book before I started, partly because I didn't know it was a book. I was just revising the story. I just wrote on Microsoft Word, which right now I'm writing a book that's probably even more complicated, and I've switched to a program called Scrivener, which helps you keep everything organized, and it's changing my life. But I don't even know. I think I had one long document, and it just kind of spooled it out. And then when I revised, I went through probably three drafts with my agent before we sent it to my publisher. And then also when I did two drafts with my editor after my publisher bought it, I was mostly adding things, so I'd kind of go into the middle of it and write another section. But one thing that happened during edits was that the structure actually got simplified, which is sort of horrifying to think about now in retrospect, because the way I wrote it, I would write a section sort of in Joan's ongoing life, and the whole book's written in present tense, so her with her son in California, and then I would get to a place where I felt a piece of information was missing, and I would jump back in time and, you know, talk about her helping the Soviet star Arslan defect or something like that, and then return to the original story, which I was told very gently it was incredibly confusing for the reader. So part of what happened in edits was that different sections that were in sort of sequential years got fused into one section, which allowed the book to sort of stay in the same time and place and just sort of sweep forward for longer instead of being quite so chopped up. But yeah, it really, for such a complicated book, I never felt very lost in it. And I think that had to do with what I was describing, my sort of initial process of just happily writing along and then feeling there's something that needed to be filled in and jumping backwards. And I didn't really have the whole arc of it in my head beforehand, and it just kind of developed as I thought of things. So that's probably really unhelpful.
It's not. And how much did that process differ from the process for your first novel, For Seating Arrangements? Totally different.
Quite a lot. Yeah, Seating Arrangements is structured really differently. It really just takes place over 2 days with some sort of forays into the past. And Seating Arrangements, I wrote some pieces out of order. Like, I had a sense of events I wanted to happen somewhere in the future in the book. And so I would write scenes and sort of keep them until I got to them, which sort of gave me waypoints that I was looking for as I wrote. Seating Arrangements in a way was simpler, but it was also more difficult because I was sort of in this pressurized situation of, okay, now I'm writing my first novel. Whereas Astonish Me, I didn't even admit to myself that it was a novel until that first 90-page draft was done. I just sort of thought I was messing around, and I had a different project that I'd put on hold. So it was really the most pleasurable writing experience I'll probably ever have, because it was just me kind of amusing myself.
It does sound pretty great, given the environment. And it sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it really was.
We're drawing down on our time, but I wanted to give you a chance to leave our listeners with writing advice. I know you went through the amazing program in Iowa, the MFA program, and with two novels under your belt now, you know, advice that you've gotten along the way that has helped you and served you, and what you can tell us to spur us along.
I don't know if I ever got this advice, but having taught a little bit here and there and spending a lot of time around writers, and what I tell myself as well is that I think it's really important to keep your ego out of it as much as you can. You know, if you're writing to impress someone or, you know, theoretical readership, if you're writing to look good, you know, none of that is helpful. It's better to just sort of write in service of a story or characters or setting, really, or the language. Just any element is more important than you are.
That's great. You know, that's great wisdom, because I thought I read something you said about how, you know, novel writing is just so grueling that you really have to be engaged in the subject matter and genuinely interested in yourself, and then it just comes alive for the reader.
Yeah, it's true. It's brutal. You have to sort of ignore everything else and just kind of keep going a little bit at a time. But there's really no room for showing off in there, I don't think.
Yeah, right. Sad.
This
was a great, great read, now out in paperback. Tell us where we can find you online. I know, because I've read 100,000 interviews with you, and you have a great website. Is MaggieShipstead.com?
That's right. My favorite form of social media is Instagram. I'm at Shipstead. I'm on Twitter very reluctantly. And I also have a Facebook author page. I think it's Maggie Shipstead Author or something. And that's the way you could, people send me messages there, and I usually reply, unless they're weird. I'm also answering questions on Goodreads later this month, so you could submit a question now, and I'll get to it later.
That sounds perfect. Maggie Shipstead, thanks so much for taking the time this morning. This was a huge pleasure.
Thank you, Marie. It was lots of fun.
Thanks. That was Maggie Shipstead. The book is Astonish Me. It is out now in paperback. And stay with me. Lily King will be on for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
Best I ever. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast. We are on iTunes under College Radio, or we're on Barbara's website, penonfire.com. We are on Facebook. You can find us on Writers on Writing, KUCI FM. All of our podcasts are up there. We are on Twitter. I don't know anything about Twitter, but I know we're on Twitter. We're on Stitcher. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone, on with the show. Lily King grew up in Massachusetts and received her BA in English Literature from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, her MA in Creative Writing from Syracuse. She's taught English and Creative Writing in several universities and high schools in this country and abroad. Her first novel, The Pleasing Hour, won the Barnes & Noble Award and was a New York Times notable book, as well as an alternate for the Penn Hemingway Award. Her second, The English Teacher, was a Publisher's Weekly Top 10 Book of the Year, a Chicago Tribune Best Book of the Year, and winner of the Maine Fiction Award. Her third novel, Father of the Rain, was a New York Times Editor's Choice, a Publisher's Weekly Best Novel, and winner of the New England Book Award for Fiction. It was translated into various languages, but it is her latest novel, Euphoria, that was released in June of last year. It won the Kirkus Award for Fiction in 2014, the New England Book Award for Fiction in 2014, and was included in the New York Times Book Review's 10 Best Books of 2014, Times Top 10 Fiction Books of 2014, and Amazon's Best Books. Reviewed on the cover of the New York Times Book Review, Emily Aiken called Euphoria a taut, witty, fiercely intelligent tale of competing egos and desires in a landscape of exotic menace. It's being translated into numerous languages, and a feature film is underway. Lily joins me this morning. It is my huge pleasure to welcome her. Hello.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for doing this. So I'm going to give you a chance to take us inside Euphoria for people who haven't yet read it. I'm sorry for them, but we will stimulate some reading. A whole group of friends of mine had it as their book club book for the last month, and they're all raving about it. So they were very excited about hearing you this morning.
That's so nice to hear.
So take us into Euphoria. Tell us a little bit about where it came from, the inspiration for it, and a little bit about the characters.
Okay. Never intended to write this book. It's a funny thing. I was just starting my third novel, Father of the Rain, when a friend of mine came to my house and said, I'm taking you to my favorite bookstore. We go into Portland, Maine, and the bookstore is closing. There's hardly anything left in the store, and I picked up this biography of Margaret Mead because I felt like I had to buy something. And I go home, and I actually started reading it, and I was really, really quite intrigued. I'd never taken anthropology. I kind of avoided science all my life. I got to this point where Margaret Mead was 33 years old, and she was up the Sepik River in Papua New Guinea, which was called then the territory of New Guinea. And she was with her second husband, and they together met another anthropologist who... They had been there for about a year and a half, and it hadn't been going well. And this other anthropologist brought them and found them another tribe to study. And he kind of hung around, Gregory Bateson. And Mead fell very quickly in love with him, and he with her. And I read that little tiny chapter in this biography, and I thought, oh, my God, this would make a great novel. But I never thought that I would be the one to write that novel. I was already starting my new novel. But that novel, Father of the Rain, was kind of hard to write, and I'd have to take long breaks from it. And whenever I take a break, I'd just sort of start reading a little bit more about Mead and Bateson and Mead's second husband that she was with then, Ray O'Fortune. And I'd started taking notes, and every time I took a note, I'd get a little bit of an idea. And, after a whole notebook full of notes and ideas, and Father of the Rain, when that was finally done, I just thought, I'm going to give this a try. And very quickly, it went from being a story
a true story about Margaret Mead. That's really the story I thought that I was going to write. The minute I got them on the boat, they're leaving one tribe, they're going to another one, they became fictional characters, and I couldn't even work in one scene that I actually knew about. It just didn't ring true by the time I got there because they had become fictional. And so their ending is not at all what happens to Margaret Mead. And it is in no way something that one should read thinking that you'll find out exactly what happened to Margaret Mead and her two husbands.
Now, I read in an interview that you yourself sort of fell a little bit in love with Bateson as you were reading about it, as you were doing the research. And the book becomes from from his point of view. Well, not name change, but Bankson's point of view. Do you think that would have been possible if you hadn't fallen a little bit in love with this guy yourself? Or talk about how it started out as Nell's story and became Bankson's story over time.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of David McCullough. I remember reading an interview with him and how he had started writing this biography about both John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, and how he sort of fell in love with John Adams and kind of tossed Thomas Jefferson to the side and just wrote that great John Adams biography. So I feel like it was a little bit like that with me. I did think that I would tell the story through her eyes, through this character who is very much like Margaret Mead. And I did for one chapter, and then I got to the second chapter, one chapter of the first draft. And then I got to the second chapter, and I thought, you know, I really need to have the scene where Bateson is really depressed and maybe possibly suicidal. And I wrote that, and it's about 3 pages long. And I got in right, and I thought, okay, well, I'll just write it from his perspective, inside his head. And, you know, I probably won't use it, but it'll just help me kind of understand who he is. And the minute I did that, he just clicked in a way that she hadn't for me. I don't exactly know why. Gregory Bateson has this really tragic backstory with his two brothers, both of whom were dead by the time he was in this part of the world in 1933. And I initially thought that I could just write about him because the biography I read about him was so appealing and made him so attractive and interesting and funny that I thought, well, it'll be easy to write a character who falls in love with this guy. And then I started writing from his head and I thought, oh, this whole book is his story. Mm-hmm. And it took me a long time, several drafts, to really accept that fact, but I kind of knew it the minute I'd written that little short chapter.
I wonder, once you have a character like Bankson, and then you need to have a character like Fenn, who's a bit in opposition to him, and we have this very interesting love triangle. Was it difficult to keep, because Fenn's not the most likable guy a lot of the time. Do you feel like you were writing characters in opposition to each other, or obviously, I mean, you had to, I had some sympathy for Fenn here and there, but you had to keep him, you know, in the game. Talk a little bit about writing men, in this kind of dichotomy where they both have to be fully fleshed out, and one is slightly more likable than the other.
I know. You know, it's funny because it is from Bankson's point of view, and so you're probably getting kind of the worst picture of him because Bankson is, while he's sympathetic to Fenn to a degree, he also sees him as a little bit of a monster with Nell, and I think I felt very sympathetic to Fenn because he is so overshadowed by his wife, and he's quite ambitious, but she's so much more ambitious, and she's having, back home, she's having a lot of success that they sort of hear about through the mail, and he realizes that her reputation is just really, really growing, and they also have incredibly different work habits. He's just, you know, he wants more of a balance in life, and she really just wants to work all the time. And he's not particularly sympathetic to all of her ailments. The tropics don't really suit her. And she has, you know, a bad ankle and bad arms and all sorts of ulcers. And then Bankson comes along, and he's been completely alone. And so all of his sort of sensitivities are so ready to give. And Fenn is just kind of tired of giving. And they've been in this really claustrophobic situation for a year and a half. But for Bankson, it's so fresh to have new people around. And so he can be his very best self. And he sees Fenn sort of at his very, very worst.
Right. You had this really great observation about how people can be strong in some senses and weak in others, and you have this incredibly strong female character in some senses and weak mm-hmm. in others. How mm-hmm. true is that? And, I think a lot of people wondered, you know, how does a woman like this stay with a man like that for as long as she does? But these are great, these are great insights to her character.
You know, I also say to that, I get that sometimes, too, and you know, they married on on their way out, or, you know, 2 days or something, or the day before they left to go on this big trip. So they had a whirlwind romance on a ship returning from their last field trip. That's how they met, and then they get married, and then they go off on this field trip, and then they're stuck in the jungle for a year and a half together alone in a wildly claustrophobic situation, in a work situation too. And they were in, especially their last tribe before the book starts, they're with a very violent people, and she's so committed to her work, she's not going to leave. I mean, I didn't feel that she had a lot of choice at that point. I mean, I definitely felt that when she got back, she would leave him, you know, when she got back to the States and back home. But she needed to get this work done, and so she kind of had to make it work with him.
Right.
I didn't feel like she had a lot of options.
Yeah, right. You are tuned into Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Lily King. The book is Euphoria. I read this very interesting piece. You were talking about your own family dynamics growing up and how you had sort of four different family structures through a series of marriages of your parents and siblings mm-hmm. and more step-siblings. And I thought that was a great observation that you made in the interview of how you have to learn to live in different family dynamics with their own rules and mores and structure, and if that sort of led you to be interested in anthropology and, you know, kind of whether Margaret Mead chose you or if you chose her, and that family dynamic growing up and how it fed into it.
Yeah, I mean, I often attribute my many families as a child is, a reason I became a writer, because you have to be such a close observer of, you know, the differences between these sort of family cultures. And then, you know, publishing this book and realizing, wow, you know, I focused in on anthropology unexpectedly, you know, why would I do that? And so that's definitely something I came up with. I think that probably does have something to do with it. I do think every family does have a slightly different culture, and certainly the families my parents married into after they divorced were extremely different. And I would go from one to the other, you know, on a Friday, and in order to kind of keep the peace and make it all work, I felt like I really had to tune in to what was right and what was wrong in that situation. And I remember, you know, certainly coming back to my mother's on Sunday night, it was hard for me to kind of get the wild out of myself, because it was kind of wilder at my father's. And my mother didn't understand it, you know, and that would always be like a little bit of an adjustment on Sundays.
That's funny. That's a fantastic insight. And mm-hmm. and writing is being sort of an antidote to that, to, you know, figure it out on paper as opposed to...
Yes, exactly. And have a little control. I mean, I really think that I started writing in high school because it gave me a world where I had more control than I did in my regular life.
Right. The novel has so many wonder. The sexual dynamics obviously are wonderful. Your writing of sex is wonderful. It's
thank you.
Weird and wacky and wonderful. different power structures, different sexual structures. And Michelle Hennepin had a great insight about how the work itself is very erotic and eroticized, and obviously how she falls in love with Banks and through the work. So talk a little bit about writing sex, if it comes easy to you, how you think about it. This is very hard for a lot of novelists to do this right. So tell us how.
Well, I've always sort of prided myself on my writing of bad sex. I mean, I'm not sure I've ever really written good sex. I think that is harder and much easier to fall into cliche and, kind of satisfying sex. I mean, there's one satisfying sex scene in this book, and I quickly, stayed to black. The bad sex is just fun, and as you said, just kind of weird and quirky and unexpected, and I like doing that, and I don't know. I mean, I'm always, you write the stuff up in your study, you're alone in your pajamas, and you feel a little bit like a perv, I don't really know. I never have any idea if it's. I don't know if my editor will tolerate it or if anybody will, kind of feel like it has any resonance in the real world. I just try to be as honest as I can or as I see it. I just sort of see it and just try to write it and try not to be gross.
Well, it strikes me as much more authentic. I mean, people have such a weird relationship, I think, with sex, and it's so much easier to identify with the awkward sex than the good sex. I think you're exactly right about that. That's funny. I really like this notion that you started out with this saying, I don't write novels like that. These historical novels are not for me, and somehow I don't have permission to write it because I'm not that kind of writer. And then back-ending yourself into it by giving yourself permission and then completely jumping off, doing a lot of research, but disregarding the research in some ways to make the novel really your own. In that whole evolution of coming to this conclusion that you are a person who could write that any novel, really, do you feel that now? Do you feel like nothing is now off limits the way things felt limited before you took this on?
Yes, absolutely. I really do. But the scary thing is that just before this interview, I've been working on my new novel. I think maybe I have 10 or 11 pages because I've been researching all fall and I've just started writing this week. And, I think it's really easy to sort of theoretically say, oh, yeah, now I can write jungle in, Papua New Guinea. I could do anything. And I've taken on this really, really challenging subject of which I know nothing except that now I've kind of tried to educate myself for the past 3 months. But then you start it and, there's no added confidence. There's no extra little boost you get. I just feel like I'm very, very much at the bottom of the hill with my huge boulder on my back. And I don't even know if I can take a step, let alone kind of get to the top of it. It just all feels very terrifying, but it is exciting to think of going someplace new. I mean, I really am excited about it, but, most of the time when I write, I just feel scared. I feel scared I'm not doing it the way I should be or the way I wanted to.
Yeah. So Euphoria went through, I thought I read 7 full drafts of starting really over again 7 full times. Is that okay? I mean, that's daunting to start over with a new project. Think about that. But did you feel what were each pass through? I don't know what my question is. I'm just trying to figure out how you get the gumption up each and every pass through to say, I'm just going to do it again. I'm just going to start again.
Yeah, it was really trying to figure out the perspective. That was the thing that it wasn't so much the structure or anything else, really. I knew what the scenes were. I knew what I wanted to have in there. I already had written the dialogue. It was just, you know, who was going to be seeing all of this. And so I first had it just her, and I think I had it maybe in the third person, then the first person, and then I had all three of them, you know, different switching points of view pretty rapidly, and then I separated it by chapter, and then I, you know, I had, at one point I had Zamboon's perspective in there, you know, who is one of the members of the tribe that they're studying, and, you know, it went all over the place until I finally just realized it was first person Bankson with him kind of supplementing for the reader some kind of third person narratives of Nell here and there,
mm-hmm.
sort of fill them in.
Right. Right. My guest this morning is Lily King. The book is Euphoria. I hope we can have sort of a philosophical discussion about endings without, you know, giving anything away. But endings, I think, are very difficult. And this was quite a stunning ending, a great image. So tell me a little bit about if you know when you're at the end, how easily that came to you.
It came slowly. I had originally, I think the original ending that my agent and my editor both saw was maybe the chapter before the ending that exists now. And I didn't have that idea at all. I didn't know that we were going to take this leap in time and end, you know, at the museum. And I was driving in Portland, Maine on a highway, just turning off the highway. I was late to meet a friend for lunch, and I suddenly saw it all. And I don't know where it came from. I just remember being concerned about being late for lunch. And then suddenly this idea came, and I just grabbed a little notebook that I have in my car and a pen. And as I was turning off the exit, I was just frantically scribbling down some ideas. And that came very late, very late. But I had the emotional idea. I knew that, you know, kind of where I wanted him to be emotionally. But I didn't have that scene. And that before, a couple of months before that, I had gone to the American Museum of Natural History in New York, and I had gone around and taken pictures and taken notes, and, you know, it didn't speak to me at all. I mean, I didn't think it did. I mean, it was interesting to see and everything, and I had waited way too long to go. But then that image that it ends on came to me 2 months later on the highway. I can't really explain that.
Amazing. Do you find yourself driving down that highway a lot now, late for lunch? Do you?
I go on that highway every single day, at least once. And nothing like that has ever happened again, alas.
alas, we're drawing down on our time. But are there any big things we've missed, words of writing advice you want to leave us with, anything that we should have covered that we didn't?
Gosh, I can't think of anything.
I like that Old Filth was I haven't read Old Filth, but Old Filth was the book that you read that sort of was your guiding principle for switching points of view. And do you read outside of your genre a lot to get inspiration, or crawl old bookstores apparently for inspiration? I know it sounds like it comes from unexpected places.
I try to read a lot of novels. I mean, I find that I am most inspired by novels and short stories. And Old Filth was really the book that gave me the courage to write it from Bankson's perspective. I fell so in love with Old Filth himself. And I was about to say that narrator, I mean, it is told from a third person, but you feel very close to him. And I just think that book by Jane Gardam is just a marvel. I think I've read it 3 times. I don't feel like I could have written Euphoria without it. And I always keep Virginia Woolf on my desk to the Lighthouse, sometimes, and Mrs. Dalloway sometimes too. And then Shirley Hazard has a book called The Evening of the Holiday. It came out in 1963, and I really love that book, too. I often pick up that book to just kind of remember good writing.
It's funny how many women find themselves writing men easier than other women. You know, the farther away that you get from your own biographical demographic, the easier it is to write. And that's...
That's interesting. I guess the English teacher was part from a teenage boy and part from sort of a woman who was older than I was when I was writing the book, but who's now younger than me. that was the first time I'd written from, I think, certainly a novel from at least a partial male perspective. But I was surprised how much I really enjoyed this. Yeah. And it's funny to be back. I'm back now in the voice of a young woman. And it feels weird.
Right. That's funny. Sadly, that is all the time we have for. We didn't even get to hear you read from the novel after all of that. So, rats. But Lily King, thank you so much for taking the time this morning. Huge pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Take care.
That was Lily King. The book is Euphoria. It is out and available. Great read. That's all the time we have for this week, but we will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. And I encourage you to check out, we are in a new quarter right now, and there are some amazing programming. There's a new show right before this one. You listen to 567 Wait at 8 o'clock this morning, but we have wonderful shows on film school. We have a new food show on Thursday mornings. Claudia Shambaugh does an incredible show on Tuesday mornings, Ask a Leader. The list goes on and on. Mari does a legal show on Monday morning. So even if you love our show, keep listening. But there are some other great, great programs on KUCI, all on drive time slots all throughout the week. And of course, amazing music shows. Stay tuned for Teddy coming up next, giving you a little bit of reggae. And until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.